Good afternoon. The House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Welcome back, Commissioner. Glad to see you here.
Madam Chair, thank you. I think these mics work better in here, I'm sure.
Yeah, I hope they're not worse, goodness sake. So we'll hope for the best. So we're running a little behind today because we had a session that pushed the 10 o'clock committee a little late. So I know people will be coming in, so we'll take care of a little preliminary business with approval of the minutes. And do we have to do two or just one? Two. All right. So we need to do approval of the January 11th minutes, and they should all be in your packets, members. Let's see. Representative Peterson, would you
Madam Chair, approve the minutes as presented?
All right. So Representative Peterson moves approval of the January 11th minutes. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Minutes January 11th approved. And now we also have minutes for January 12th, which was the joint meeting with the Education Innovation Policy Committee. Let's see. Representative Dabney, if you had a chance to thoroughly review the minutes.
You know, I was just doing exactly that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So I'd like to move adoption.
All right. Representative Dabney moves adoption of the January 12th minutes. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, minutes are approved. Thank you both, Representative Dabney and Peterson. All right, and we've got a few more folks who have come in, so I think we are ready to go. And again, the purpose of today's hearing is to do an overview of the early childhood education programs, and the newest of which being the voluntary preschool program, which was an initiative from the governor that was started with this current school year. And so we're pleased to have Commissioner Caselius with us and Mr. Uni. Welcome. And if you'd both just introduce yourselves for the record so we have that on the tape, but we'll welcome your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope you can hear me. A little bit under the weather today, but I'll do my best. But if I sound a little muffled, it's because I think I got what a lot of people have in Minnesota. Today we'll be mostly focused on voluntary pre-K. It was my understanding that we would be talking about voluntary pre-K, not all of the early learning programs. However, I do have a high-level kind of introduction to introduce to you some of the other programs of the ways that we're offering choice to families. So I'm Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education, here with Adosh Uni, Director of Government Relations. I have several of my staff behind me that work in the Early Learning Division, and also Wayne Nguyen, Assistant Commissioner, who oversees Policy and Government Relations. So today I'm going to talk briefly about the voluntary kindergarten and then take your questions. The selection process for issuing those awards, in general, the ranking and the concentration factors used in order to get them out as fast as possible and also to the most neediest children. Funding model overview, the FY18 application process that's been started, and implementation of voluntary pre-kindergarten statutory requirements. The historical significance of this is that we started on early learning even before 2011 with investments in early childhood family education known as ECFE. And school readiness. We have school readiness in almost every single district, offering some level of preschool opportunities for families either through their early childhood family education or their school readiness programs or a combination thereof. Some schools offer this as a fee-based, and some tie together other funding sources like Title I, school readiness, and now scholarships and VPK. In 2011-12, we began with scholarships. I mentioned this in my comments last week, with a $4 million appropriation to begin this work. There was some work done by several groups in the business community who got this started. The MELF group, especially in United Way, did some studies and then brought those to the governor right away, and he was very interested in starting early childhood and having that be an important priority in closing achievement gaps. In 2013 and 14, as you all know, we did all-day kindergarten, so kids have to be ready for all-day kindergarten. We increased the funding for early childhood scholarships at that time, increased funding for ECFE and school readiness, And then in 2015, passed voluntary pre-kindergarten, which we'll talk about today mostly. Additional funding in school readiness. Additional funding for Head Start, which is really supporting our neediest families and children. We put more money in early learning scholarships. We also built out our high-quality system called Parent Aware that we partner with the Department of Human Services on, and with the Department of Health, increased some funding for home visiting to support families and services to children. So those were several things that we were able to accomplish. What's important to note there on that slide is that we've taken a mixed delivery approach to offer choice to families, and then just last year expanding that choice with voluntary pre-kindergarten so that parents had a school-based option nearby their home, one that aligned curriculum with preschool, and also provided special education and English language learner services for children that need it. So it's a really good option for some families, as is scholarships for some other families, or even our CCAP program, which is our child care assistance program, administered through the Department of Human Services for working families that may need that additional help with child care expenses. So the goals of the program are to access high-quality early learning programs, and we've been building out quality. We were able to secure the Race to the Top grant in 2012, also secured Promise Neighborhood grant to work with some of our most impoverished neighborhoods within Minneapolis and St. Paul, and then expanded that work to some other transformation zones. The past legislative session, I believe in Northfield and St. Cloud and Rochester, I believe, and Itasca County and White Earth, and doing some additional work with them with wraparound services. We also hope to reduce educational achievement gaps and disparities in opportunities and access to high-quality child care, ensure every child is ready to succeed in school and life, and again, to provide that alignment in a school-based environment near homes for families to align curriculum, to align support for special education and ECSC services, to build stronger relationships with families, and to provide early support for English language learners. Our FY17 funding provided for $25 million to school districts. We had overwhelming demand. We divided these dollars into four buckets based on the percentage of state kindergarten enrollment. Minneapolis and St. Paul public schools receiving 10%, other school districts located in Metro Equity Region receiving about 40%, school districts located in the Rural Equity Region receiving 43%, and approved charters receiving 7%. Statutory criteria within each of the groups. We ordered ranked based on the following criteria outlined in statute, which is the concentration of kindergarten students eligible for free and reduced price lunches by school site on October 1st of the prior year. Presence or absence of a 3 or 4 year Parent Aware program or a Head Start program in the district that's in close proximity to the district. And then the applications that we received. As I mentioned, we had really good interest, even in the short turnaround frame that we had. We received applications from over 184 school districts. These were complete applications. There were some who had interest but maybe didn't get it completed. And charter schools with a total of 260 sites applying. Application requests included funding for over 10,000 children, and more than 230 participants joined in 3 webinars. We answered over 200 emails, number of phone mails, and 94 unique individuals during this period to provide technical assistance. So then in the selection, the applications were available right away as after it was signed. We were working on this during the whole session, trying to make sure that we would be available in a short turnaround. So they were available first week of June and also then due by July 1st. We commend our school districts for turning these applications around quickly. Many were waiting on this funding and hoping for it. Decisions made by statutory required deadline of August 1st through an application and ranking process. The capped allocation allowed approval for funding for 74 districts and charters at 102 sites, and approximately 3,300 children are currently being served in VPK. We were not able to fund the 109 districts and charters that applied and over 122 sites, and 6,800 children were not able to get funded in this first round. Once a school district receives the funding, they are able to keep it in future years as long as all their program requirements meet statutory requirements. We got in here a little map for you to be able to see where they were applied for but were not funded, and where they were applied for and funded. We also have a triangle that indicates where charter schools applied, and a circle where it indicates that a charter school applied but was not funded. Excuse me, the triangle is not funded, and the circle is where the charter school was funded. So you can see it's good distribution throughout the state, based actually by the statute and the way that the requirements require that it regionally gets out to the state. So just a quick overview of the funding model. It is a formula-driven model with a cap on the total state aid. Students at participating sites generate up to 0.6 pupil units, and districts can choose to have use all of that or some of that funding. All pupil-driven formulas apply, so that if you receive QComp dollars, then those would increase, for instance, with your additional enrollment in ADMs for pre-K. So enrollment is generated by voluntary pre-K is added to the district charter existing student data for calculating all revenues and aids. The FY18 application process and current statute requires applications for the following year to be submitted by January 30th. Current application process opened on January 4th of this school year. All applications are due by 4 p.m. on January 30th, 2017. And currently funded programs must confirm their intent to continue their programs and inform us of any changes to their programs. Unfunded districts and charters are encouraged to submit a new application. There won't be any changes to those applications, so there shouldn't be any new work for them unless there's changes in this body and requirements around statutory requirements. But there would be a new prioritization if any new funding is proposed and allocated for an expansion of the current program. Four webinars have been hosted with over 250 attendees so far. So that's the grant and the way that it's gone out, and I would entertain any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. We've got a list forming here, but I have a couple of questions for you just as you get started. So starting with the last slide, and I'll go backwards through my questions. I jotted them down as you went, but you mentioned possibly new prioritization. So if there is more funding allocated, is it safe to say that all those schools that are currently on the pilot program would be able to continue, or would you anticipate seeking to reprioritize new applications that may come in? Maybe a school with a different demographic that may seem more needy, if you will, or deserving of this, or would you all promise that all the schools that are currently on this program would continue?
Madam Chair, the current programs that have been funded will continue to be funded, but there are some who applied that we were not able to fund, who went through the work of getting their applications in. It's our intent to review those applications as they resend them in, but then that new list that's created would have to be prioritized based on any statutory requirements or any new statutory requirements. Unless this body acts differently to change statute, anyone who was in the program, it will be guaranteed to be able to continue that ongoing funding that's in the base.
Okay. Thank you. And then in the funding model overview, it's different from the scholarship model in terms that it's on a per-pupil basis. So our formulas and that is the funding stream, and it's sites can generate up to 0.6 per pupil unit. I'm just wondering how variable that is amongst the school districts that are currently in the pilot. Is it dependent on how many hours a day or a week that the students are being served? And then the other question I had relative to that is, you know, we've had a longstanding program called School Readiness, which is school-based preschool, really, for 3- and 4-year-olds, but it's a little different on a sliding scale. These districts that are in this the UPK pilot, or VPK, I should say, are they operating two separate programs completely, or are they combining them with their current school readiness programs?
Madam Chair, we see this all over the place. Some school districts are using compensatory integration funding, general ed funding. Some have done referendums for it. Some are using some of their school improvement monies. Some are using the VPK money. They're using their scholarships and putting together programs in multiple ways. So we see this kind of all over the place. And to answer your question about the 0.6, they can use part of that or all of that. Or they can use other funds to augment that. Some schools are using fees that are not in the voluntary pre-kindergarten program to create preschool programs with their school readiness or after-school programs or one-day programs. There's been some flexibility in law around use of ECFE funding. So we're also seeing school districts use ECFE funding to establish pre-K programs. So they're all the way from one day a week to 5 days a week all day. It's up to the local school districts to decide what they can afford and what is appropriate and what the demand is, really, for those programs within their schools and what partnerships they have. Some of the programs also are using a mixed delivery method, so they might be partnering with their local Head Start or a daycare center, or providing services to in-home care providers, having a teacher go out, for instance, to an in-home care provider one or two times a week. So they're getting very creative in how to provide these services for preschool.
Thank you. And do you know in how many of the districts participating in the pilot are partnering with an outside provider, either a private provider to pair up to offer services?
There's two sites currently with Head Start.
Head Start, okay. On the funding component, I know it was a total of $25 million, so the appropriation was limited to that, and then obviously distributed on a per pupil basis with our funding formula. But there is also, I think it's $600,000 for the department for administration of the program, and that there is also a levy money as part of that as well to offset some levies. So I was just wondering first about the $600,000 for the department's administration. Mm-hmm. Kind of what are the major things that go into or that comprise that funding, what it's spent on. I assume part of it is obviously the selection process. Mm-hmm. But then what happens in terms of follow-up and what kind of information you may be gathering on sort of the success of these programs. We've had studies of the effectiveness of the scholarship and the various programs that are quality rated. What do you have envisioned for this? And then I think it's $3 million in levy offsets are also part of that $25 million. So I just wanted to mention that so if people were wondering how that $25 is allocated.
Madam Chair, I'm not prepared to talk about the levy offset unless you are, Doge. I'd have to get Tom Melcher to talk a little bit more technical about the levy offsets and that that question. As for the staffing, it is used to administer the program, to work with the other outside administrators, with the program to do professional learning and opportunities for teachers and to work with our data systems. And so that's what we're using that funding for.
Okay.
Can I mention, Madam Chair,
yes.
The 0.6 in relation also different than the scholarships. So for some districts, the scholarship award is up to $7,500 because of the cap. And then you have the variance that happens depending on which district you're in and whether you get the other aid entitlements with it. You know, so if you're a district without QComp or without integration aid or without a large compensatory, then your formula would be different than it would be for those who are have kids typically in higher poverty areas or receiving EL funding or American Indian funding or all those other things that go with the special populations, which is critical when you're looking at closing those achievement gaps and the additional resources needed for that.
Okay, but there is no minimum number of hours for the programs that the schools are offering through this program.
Madam Chair, to get the 0.6, you would need to offer at least 350 hours to get the whole entire 0.6
amount. Okay. Amount. Thank you. I will suspend with my questions.
Wait a minute. Let me just get that specific to make sure I don't repeat.
Okay. Okay.
You get 0.42. What one should I say?
Mr. Udy.
No, sorry.
Okay.
Mr. Udy, welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, the way the math works out is that if you do the minimum 350 hours, you get people weighting of about 0.42. If you do the maximum or the minimum to get the max of 0.6 is 510 hours. So 510 hours and up gets you that 0.6 weighting.
Okay.
I apologize for that error.
No, that's fine. But I just wanted to make clear so members understood that there is a minimum number of hours that the programs must offer to qualify for the pilot, correct? Yes.
To get the funding.
All right. So we have a number of members on the list, so I'm going to hold the rest of my questions and move on to members. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, besides this funding, maximum and minimum on hours, what else do the programs require? Because your statement under the program selection for 17 is if they continue with all the program requirements. So what are the program requirements?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Chair Erickson, the requirements are that they have the number of hours that we just discussed, that they have comparable pay, that they're parent aware rated. Let me get that list out. It's right there in law. Voluntary pregame pre-K program provide instruction through play-based learning to foster children's social-emotional development, subdivision 2. Measure each child's cognitive and social skills using a formative measure aligned to state's early learning standards. Provide comprehensive program content, including the implementation of curriculum and assessments. Provide instructional content and activities that are sufficient length and intensity to address learning needs with at least 350 hours. This is what I was getting to. Provide voluntary pre-kindergarten instructional staff with salaries comparable, which I mentioned. Coordinate appropriate kindergarten transitions with families, community-based pre-kindergarten programs. Involve parents in program planning and transition planning by implementing parent engagement activities that are culturally and linguistically responsive activities in pre-kindergarten through third grade that are aligned with early childhood family education under Section 124D13. Coordinate with relevant community-based services, including health and social agencies. Coordinate with all relevant school district programs. Ensure staff-to-child ratios are 1 to 10 and a maximum group size of 20. And provide high-quality coordinated professional development training and coaching for both school district and staff. And implement strategies that support the alignment of professional development, instruction, and assessments. And mixed delivery is optional.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Commissioner, that's a long, long list. So what's the accountability here for a program so that you know they're fulfilling all program requirements to continue to get this funding? Because this is, you'd have to be collecting a lot of data, I think, to ensure that these dollars are being used as, we intended this funding. So how is the, what's the accountability measure?
Commissioner.
Or measures.
So, Madam Chair, the accountability is, one, a lot of this is included within the Parent Aware rated as high-quality instruments. And so we do have all programs Parent Aware rated. However, we do provide in our application assurances that that they are providing this, similar to how we do our standards. And we, in a standards-based education, we lay out the expectations. School districts say that they are doing these things, and they provide us assurances that they are doing these high-quality elements. So we have assurances that, that tell us. We certainly don't have the staff or capacity to go out to every program and check their voluntary pre-K programs other than their parent aware rating that we do.
So, Madam
Representative Erickson.
So, Commissioner, the parent aware rating has to be a 3 or 4, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Commissioner.
And in rural Minnesota, we're having a hard time getting to 3s and 4s. I just had a big meeting last Friday with many providers who are really concerned because there are so many stumbling blocks to getting even a 3. So I'm a little uncomfortable with this assurance statement you made and the fact that all of this program requirement is centered around the parent aware rating. Not that I'm opposed to the parent aware rating, but I do know that in rural Minnesota, we're having struggles. And I'm wondering if, indeed, I have a couple of these pilots, if that's really true in my area. I don't think it is, but maybe they're still working toward it. So when they made their application, they had to assure you that they would get to a 3 or 4. Is that correct, Commissioner?
Commissioner.
Or did they have to have it already?
Madam Chair, I think just about every single school district in the state that outside of a handful are parent aware rated and were parent aware rated at a 3 or 4, and they might even be 4s. And I would just like to mention, Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, that you know, we have kindergarten programs, first grade programs, third grade, second grade, third, all the way through 12th grade programs. And the voluntary pre-kindergarten is much like adding a grade. And so we honor the local school districts that they have quality professionals that are providing the services. I know that we've talked about licensed teachers. Working with our children, there are standards to be implemented at the school district level, pre-K through 12th grade, and those should be aligned. We've done significant training in our school districts with pre-K through 3rd grade alignment of the curriculum and still continue to do that deep training with our school districts. So it's not just the parent aware rating, but also our continued work with school districts around implementation of our Minnesota state standards pre-K through 12. Just like any other grade.
Representative Chair, just one last concern. Well, I think the dilemma is that the public program, the pilot, is receiving the 3 or 4 parent aware rating, but then in the private sector, even in Head Start in my area, there's concern that they can't reach the 3 or 4 rating when, in fact, it seems like the public program is just automatically getting it. So this is raising issues, I think, and it's shutting out the private programs whose instructors are being told things, that, you know, information for which I don't think they're supposed to be responsible. So I'm having real issues with how this is playing out in that I have no problems with the program, but I do think it's shutting out the private programs who are struggling to get the 3 or 4 ratings who feel that now they're being compromised because the parents are going to the public program rather than using their services. I think we have some issues to work out here, Commissioner, and I'll keep working. I'm working with Representative Franson on this, too, because I don't know about other areas, but I have deep concern in my area. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, we will do everything possible and within our control and working with the Department of Human Services to continue to offer training and support to private and in-home and neighbor caregivers in order to ensure that their high-quality for our students and children, and that they're provided the kind of supports that they need. And if we need to problem solve around the four-year-old problem and availability and what that does to the child care market, in rural Minnesota especially, we're open to looking at solutions for that as well, because we want this to work for everybody.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And first question I have for the Commissioner is, in getting back to what Representative Erickson just mentioned, one of the criteria that you mentioned, at least in this first round, is the presence or absence of 3- and 4-star rated schools. I know, I remember in Herman Norcross, we were there one time visiting, and they said they've done preschool for many, many years because they don't have child care centers in their small communities. So kind of in what Representative Erickson talked about, some of these smaller communities don't have 3- or 4-star rated, and so being able to get that into the school is going to be a benefit because there's nothing else available. And yet that still is a concern in rural Minnesota and trying to ramp that up. But the criteria, is a criteria involved that if you don't have 3- and 4-star rated ones, does that push you towards the top to qualify for one of the grants? That'd be my first question, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, that is a consideration in terms of the proximity to a 3- or 4- rated program within the statute.
The other concern I have, thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, is 79 school districts qualified, and I have a couple of school districts in my area that qualified, which is great, and I also have a few that have applied that were not funded. And the way it sounds like, if you receive money this year, you're going to be guaranteed as long as you follow the requirements, which is good. But without any increase in funding, if we don't increase the $25 million, basically those who did not, who applied last year but were not funded, their chances of reapplying and getting funded this year are going to be very, very small, isn't, without an increase in funding? Would that be an accurate statement?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, we know that there are 7,000 children who did not receive funding. So that is absolutely accurate in that we are leaving children behind without additional funding because families and school districts want to have the option, along with all the other options that we have in a mixed delivery system, to have school-based child care or preschool for their children.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Yeah, so, well, I think this is a huge need. I don't know if we're going to be able to, what our target will be this year, Madam Chair. I don't think anyone knows that yet, but I do think the preschool area should be an area of high priority before anything else. And so I'm, because I know there's a couple school districts in my area that they're going to apply again, but from what I'm hearing, the chances are going to be very slim that they're going to get funded this year without any new funding. And so, anyway, that's a concern for me. But
I hope
thank you.
Get funded.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list is Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Over this side. And thank you, Commissioner, for being here, even while you're feeling under the weather. Just a question, in these pilot areas, I'm wondering if, along with your study of, you know, the success for the students and so on, are you or do you have plans to contact the existing early childhood providers there, the private ones, just to see the impact on them for this program? I know it, in my area, some of those have contacted me and they're feeling the stress, and my concern with this is, with very good intentions, that we end up basically forcing those people out of the market and have the unintended consequences of leaving parents no choice then. So is there a plan to look at the impact on the existing early childhood providers in these areas where the pilot is?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, at this time there isn't. That's a good suggestion. I know that some of our child care agencies are working on these things as well, so we could coordinate with them better and see if there is an actual impact.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, and thank you, Commissioner. I think that would be a great idea. It just concerns me that we end up displacing the choices that parents have, which creates a vacuum and more need for more the state programs, which are fine, but we need to give that choice. So I think that would be great to add that into whatever surveys or studies that you do.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, it says that unfunded districts are encouraged to submit new applications. Are they told why they were unfunded, and are they told how they can approve their application?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we awarded the funding based on meeting the criteria and meeting the statutory requirements regionally by the split. And so we, before having them apply, put out the list so that they could see where they were on that in relation to their level of poverty, their regional area. So they are aware on why they were not funded. It's not as though you would need to improve the quality of your application unless you didn't meet one of the statutory requirements that was in the application. So all of the applications that we got in qualified for it. So if you were not funded, it was simply because we didn't have the funding in order to fund you. So if they reapply, then they would automatically be qualified as long as there's no new statutory requirements. And then from there, we will have the prioritization based on your regional eligibility, based on proximity of a 3 or 4 star rating, and based on the concentration of poverty in your school site. And then those get ranked, and that's how that gets funded.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Commissioner, then the 7,000 children that are unfunded were qualified.
Yeah.
And these their programs were qualified.
Yeah.
The money just ran out.
Yes.
So, but each program doesn't have the same cost. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Because of all the criteria.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Representative Murphy.
Nothing more this time. But that's a serious problem for those 7,000 children.
I would agree. And I think, actually, this is a good opportunity for me to ask this question because I think it feeds into yours a little bit. Commissioner, do we know of the students that are being served under this pilot? I think you said 3,300. And there's others that would have been served if they were funded, but are those all students who were not in some other program? Were they completely unserved for preschool prior to this program, or were they perhaps in a scholarship or in a school readiness program? Are they all students newly being served that weren't served some other way?
Madam Chair, some of the programs could have been already having some preschool programs in their schools or some school readiness that they've added additional hours or days to their program or new quality components to the program. So they could have been using general ed funding or fees, and they're not charging those fees any longer for families. So there's it's multiple ways that districts are funding these programs and offering of services for pre-K services now.
Okay, so there is no requirement for the school districts in the pilot that it has to be offering a new spot to a student who did not have a spot in a pre-K program prior to this, correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. That would be a supplement and not supplant type of provision where you would say if you've had it before, you don't get it. And that is not how this is written into law.
All right. And I'm glad we were able to clarify that because that is a bit of a concern to me, I must say, as we are looking to how we're providing early childhood education and opportunities to children and families who don't have the means to have these opportunities. And I think we've really, my approach to them has been as a tool to help close the achievement gap. We know that starts early. And so it's incredibly important that we reach as many children who fall into that gap and families who qualify based on their income levels as possible. But if we're offering a pilot where we're not necessarily bringing new children in to be served who aren't being served currently, that's a bit of a concern. I mean, certainly schools may be improving their program or adding new elements to it, but if we're not serving more children who need it, I think that's something that the committee needs to wrestle with. Representative Murphy, you didn't have any additional questions?
I've concluded now.
Thank you. Representative Chair? Scott.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner, yes.
Can I comment just briefly that we are still prioritizing high-poverty schools, so they are still our highest poverty schools, and I just want to clarify that they're still going to our highest poverty or needs of schools. I just wanted to make sure I clarified.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, does the department also administer the scholarship program for pre-K?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, yes, we do in collaboration with outside partners in regions, regional administrators.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how many students are being reached through the scholarship program?
Approximately 11,000. I think it's 11,219.
Okay, thank you. And what is the department's administrative cost for the scholarship program?
Commissioner.
I have to get that. I haven't written that on my notes, my memory. $950,000.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just doing some math because I noted that you're receiving $600,000 to administer the pilot program, and if there are 3,300 children in that program, the administrative cost per child is about $181, which seems pretty high to me for administering a program. And I don't know, I'd have to do the math on the scholarship program to see if it was more or less or about the same. Maybe it is. So I think how many children, being new to this committee, how many children across the state of Minnesota would you put in the category of being high risk or in needing the early pre-K or the pre-K? If it became universal, how many? No, that's not the right question. If only the children that are targeted were reached, how many children would that be approximately across the state?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, there are approximately about 65,000 children per grade level, and we have overall about 40% of the children in Minnesota receiving free or reduced price lunch. That's around, we're rounding up a little bit in our public schools. So, and then you can take about 65% of those children typically would go to some sort of preschool, and the rest would choose other care, is what we've seen at our most saturation level would be about 65%, and I think that's somewhere around 40,000 students if we were doing universal pre-K, that we would hopefully be able to serve every four-year-old would be somewhere around 40,000 students.
Right, thanks. I'm just trying to get a number in mind of what that would cost the state. I also had another question. I know that I think it was a St. Paul, in the St. Paul Public Schools, there was an article this summer about, I think this particular school was given $600,000 for the pre-K program. And they said that not all of that money was being used for the program, that they were using that for to fund teaching assistance. Are you familiar with that article?
Commissioner.
I haven't seen that article.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Pioneer Press, August 9th, 2016, reported that the St. Paul Public Schools plan to use their $600,000 allocation not to add more slots, but rather to fund teaching assistants. And I'm just wondering if how close of tabs you're keeping on this money to make sure that it's going to preschool and not some other place.
Commissioner.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we'd have to defer to St. Paul to figure out what's happening with their preschool program and funding. I know that we provide the funding for voluntary preschool to school districts, similar to how we provide third grade literacy funding or general ed funding. We give a lot of local control on how they do their programs as long as they're meeting the statutory requirements for the funding. I see Mary here. I would assume since they still have students on the waiting list for preschool that they have children in their preschool funding and that those educational assistants that they're funding are supporting their early learning efforts and achievement gap closure. Mary, are you familiar with this article? I'm not as familiar with this. I must tell you, on August 7th of 2016, my dad took a hard fall and was hospitalized, so I missed that article. I apologize.
All right. I see Ms. Gilbert is coming down representing the St. Paul schools, so please identify yourself for the record, and perhaps you can respond to Representative Scott's question.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think there might have been two issues related to that. St. Paul serves over 1,800 students in pre-K. Some of our programs are half-day programs. Some of them are all-day programs. We get our funding. We fund the program with learning readiness dollars, pathway to scholarships, and then the one school, Obama, was one of the schools that got the voluntary pre-K. We did meet all of the eligibility requirements. We had to make sure at Obama that if a student had a scholarship, that we didn't count the scholarship money in addition to the voluntary pre-K, so we weren't double-dipping. At point six, it doesn't cover an all-day program, so we could use a combination of scholarship and the voluntary pre-K to cover the entire cost of the program. But we do have a full-time teacher, a licensed teacher in our classrooms, along with a paraprofessional. We do reserve some slots for special education students as well, which again are funded out of the special education. And we also substantially contribute to our pre-K program with our referendum. And so, as you might have heard, we had some significant budget cuts that we were undertaking last year. And so, as we take a look at funding pre-K programs, and I know that the chairman brought this up about should it all go to new students, what happened in this case is the voluntary pre-K could actually fund the highest school that was ranked in St. Paul, which gave us an opportunity to use then our referendum money to fund a program that may have gotten cut, or we had actually moved some of our programs from half-day to all-day programs this year. So all of the money that we received, plus much, much more, goes specifically to serving the 1,800-plus kids that we have in our pre-K program. I also want to mention, and I have a map, I happen to have a map here, which shows all of our pre-K sites, that we also use our pre-K money and our Pathway to Scholarships and our referendum money to do relationships with both corporate and family child care. And if the page wants to pass around the map, you can see that not only do we work with our own school-based programs, but we also are very intentionally working with pre-K providers as well that are not school-based programs.
Okay. And I'm sorry, Ms. Gilbert, could you please just identify yourself so we have that on the tape? Thank you.
Sure. I'm Mary Gilbert, and I represent the St. Paul Public Schools.
All right. Thank you.
I also want to note, too, that our programs are also evaluated. And so if you take a look, and we do measurements throughout the year related to how students are performing with literacy targets met. And so, again, as well as we have aligned our curriculum from pre-K through grade 3 to ensure that the gains that the students are making at pre-K are actually carried through to the third grade level. And I would be happy, I would love for any of you to come and visit our pre-K program in any of our sites. And I will make an appointment to see if you can come and visit one.
Thank you. Representative Scott?
That's any? All.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I'm just looking for a little clarification in my own mind here. My daughter operated a daycare facility or early for preschool facility, I guess you'd call it, for quite a number of years. And I know one of the challenges she had was hiring qualified staff. They had to be licensed teachers and so forth. And in my mind, I'm trying to figure out the difference between what she was doing and what this pre-K program is. It seems like we're putting money in that. The daycare facilities are struggling. And so it's almost competition in my mind. And the state is in competition with these folks trying to provide that service. So I just need, if you can clarify, what is the difference between what those operators are offering and what we are now offering in the public school system?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Nornes. I think you're represent Perm, Minnesota.
Well, this facility was in Fergus Falls.
Right.
I also represent Perm. That's correct.
I have a lake home up there, so
that's right.
Kind of my representative as well.
And I should add that one of my districts, Pelican Rapids, I think, was the recipient of one of these grants.
Right, yes. So the difference between voluntary pre-kindergarten and in-home care or daycare center opportunities are, there are different choices that families make. Some is with the size of students within the home or within the center. At a school-based, you have aligned curriculum. As I mentioned in my opening comments, there is additional support for families at a school that include English language learner supports, or they could include some additional supports with special education right there on site with your general education teachers. Free and reduced price lunch opportunities for kids, counseling services, nursing services, all the things that a school would typically provide for kindergarten through 12th grade student are available. Transportation, other support systems for children. That doesn't mean that there's not other opportunities that families would choose with an in-home setting. You also have many times a licensed teacher who has a deep background in early childhood development and understanding, and that may also be the case in an in-home provider, but it may also not be the case. And so there's the opportunity then to have a licensed educator potentially in many of our sites who fully understand both the developmental needs of children as well as the academic needs of children and are professionally trained for that. So I think that those are probably the largest differences. I think there could also be some cost differences for families, especially as children, younger children in a home setting. It just can sometimes be much more expensive for families.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nornes.
Well, I would think there'd be a definite easy choice for some parents to make then, because they're paying for the child care facility. They would not be paying for the public education. And so my concern is that, for example, the center I talked about, they took care of infants through 4 years. 5 years they're going to preschool or, you know, kindergarten. So if we're impacting the four-year-old part of their program, we're basically putting them almost out of business, taking a good share of their children. And I'm not opposed to any of this, really, except that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in some ways. It would be nice if we were offering more help for those centers to survive financially and lowering the cost to the parents somehow. It would just seem to me that would be a more direct way to help. But again, it's just my opinion. So thanks.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, currently our effort in the scholarship program offers families those choices to be able to make within scholarships. We have even greater effort in that program currently than we do in the voluntary pre-kindergarten program. And I think that this body has made a decision to have multiple choices for families. But it does make sense that a school-based option is available for some families. And it's a better option for some families than an in-home one, and that's the beauty of having a mixed delivery system, to be able to invest in both.
Representative Krisha, and after Representative Krisha, we've got two other witnesses, so, and that's everyone I have on my list right now. But, Commissioner, would you be able to stay if we have more questions that come up?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again for being here, Commissioner. Sorry I was a little late. I was dealing with another issue. Just a couple quick questions. And I agree with you that the schools need to play a part in this and in the whole preschool. So I see the possibilities there. One of the things that, as we look at this, was free and reduced the only criteria, and was it based on the area, not necessarily the makeup of the students? In other words, did we serve a high number of students in foster care? Do we serve a high number of kids that are homeless or maybe transient? Was any of those factors, or was it just purely free and reduced based on the school district?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, the statutory requirements was regional. So first, that was the cut, was the regional cut based on the kindergarten concentration of poverty, and then looking at concentration factors of poverty. So, and then the proximity issue of a 3 or 4 rated provider within your community. So we didn't look at foster care or homelessness. That's not part of the statutory requirements.
Representative Krisha.
And so follow up. Oh, thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair. And so follow up. So we don't know, which creates the possibility that some slots were filled with students that have gotten ahead in life, and they may have taken up slots of students that could have been in more need. We don't know. Would that be a fair statement?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, we do know that we funded school districts based on their concentration of poverty. Once you get funding for the classroom, then you can admit students to that. We are not creating segregated preschool programs with only poor children in them. They are the children that the school serves in kindergarten, first or second grade. We don't just say only the poor kids are going to get preschool.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer, Commissioner Consuelos. And with all due respect, I mean, I'm not talking about segregation. I'm talking about prioritizing children, just as we might do with special needs, or we know from certain areas of research that high transient students, for example, or foster care kids are going to benefit later in a much higher degree than other students. And so I'm curious if, you know, again, I'm not talking segregation. I think that would be nothing at all. But I do think we need to look at the research and the prioritization. And what I'm hearing is that didn't happen. It was just based on regional free and reduced.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, in the voluntary pre-kindergarten program, remember it's like adding a grade to public school. Mm-hmm. So it's very similar to what we do in kindergarten through 12th grade. The scholarship program, however, we have prioritized homelessness and foster children within our scholarship program.
Representative Krisha.
My point exactly. The next thing I would follow up with that, and thank you, Madam Chair, is if a student received a scholarship in one school district, and for family situations, a lot of times I see students in this high degree of need, they're very transient. And if they left and went to another school district, would that student be eligible for a slot, or would they just lose that opportunity?
Commissioner.
Are you talking about voluntary pre-kindergarten right now? In voluntary pre-kindergarten, those slots are given to the school district. So the school district has a set number of participants, or actually a set amount of money, and then they create their programs. But I can tell you, within school districts, having been a superintendent, that school districts are prioritizing their most neediest children in either their school readiness funding, their general ed funding, their EL funding, their American Indian funding, their integration funding, their compensatory funding. They are getting it done for kids. And this funding helps school districts to be able to provide a school-based option for families.
And one last.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And please know, I'm not trying to be entirely negative on this. One of my school district peers has done a wonderful job, and they took it out of their own general ed, and they built a wonderful preschool program. So I'm saying there's lots of opportunities. What I'm just saying is if through our policies, and we do that all the time in this committee, we look for the areas of highest needs and highest opportunities to fit that achievement gap. I would hope we could use that or learn better and push it down to these programs as well. What I'm hearing, and it may not be accurate, but what I'm hearing is there are some students that got slots or that received slots that may have taken slots up of other kids that could have used it better. And if we have no way of distinguishing that or at least looking at it, I think we have to be very cognizant of that, because Representative Scott made the notion of what are the number of highest needs kids. When you start to look at the SNAP, the MFIB, and all the way through of child protection, the number is about 47,000. And I believe we have to focus there first before we move to the outer ring. So that's all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Preschow, I'd be glad to get to you the order of poverty. Just so you know, many of the schools that were funded had very high rates of poverty within them. So, and I just think it's really important for the committee to know that we funded very high poverty schools. And when you're in that kind of situation, those schools, the whole school benefits from that funding within the school. And kids that maybe are on the cusp of not qualifying, this is the problem of the cliffs that happen with entitlement programs. You go in and out of eligibility. And so this kind of also solves that problem of families losing it simply because you don't qualify any longer. I think that that's a really positive thing, that students are guaranteed these slots within their school.
Representative Grisha?
Thank you. And I'm not a no, but I'm a yes and. So I hear what you're saying. I'm just saying I think we can continue to do better, and I'm looking for ways to get to these kids.
Me too.
Thank you. All right. So now I would ask next person on our list to testify, Erica Moss of Close But Gaps by Five, would come down. And Representative Dabney, I think you raised your hand. Did you have a question for the commissioner before we switch testifiers?
No, that's all right. I was sorry that Representative Nornes left the room because, oh, he's back. Hey. he raises a very good point for the Health and Human Services Committee about our funding of child care in the state, because it is woefully underfunded and a significant need with long waiting lists that deserves more, as you point out, it deserves more attention than it's gotten. But I do think we need to keep in mind, and the commissioner, I'll keep you at the table for just a minute longer, did make the point, the services provided in a pre-K program, a school-based pre-K program, are significantly different in kind and quality and comprehensiveness than a child care program. Pre-K is education, as she said repeatedly. It's like adding another grade. In fact, it's not like adding another grade. It is adding another grade and providing that comprehensive set of services to kids in a community setting where hopefully everybody's there. Child care is child care, and it's a different beast, critical, and particularly if we want to reach those 0 to 3-year-olds, that's probably where we should be putting significantly more money right now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I would just like Norris. To respectfully disagree that there. It's a pretty fine line, I think. I've seen it firsthand, but I'm not going to have an argument, but I think that there's a very close similarity to what we're both doing. And again, I can only speak for the Children's Corner facility. It was designed as a classroom. It was run as a classroom. They had teachers there. And the outcome from that facility, run into kids all the time that have done very well as a graduate of that particular program. So I get what you're saying. I guess I don't totally agree. We have both issues to deal with.
All right. Both agreeable gentlemen who disagree at the moment, but we appreciate the dialogue. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Appreciate it very much. Ms. Moss, if you want to come on up. And again, if you would just please state your name and affiliation for the record, and we welcome your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Erica Moss, and I'm the executive director of an organization called Close Gaps by Five. Some of you know me under a different name, Parents Aware for School Readiness. Our organization went through some changes over the summer, and one of the things that we wanted to help clarify by changing our name was, first of all, the emphasis of the work that we do. And also, I think making sure that it was easy for members to understand that we are not the Parent Aware Rating Program. It's a program that we support and advocate for, but it's not our jurisdiction. The Department of Human Services operates that program. So with that introduction, I'll get into my testimony. And I was invited today to talk about the kind of history and how things are going with the Early Learning Scholarship Program. The commissioner mentioned it several times. It's a program that started as a privately funded pilot, which is my link to it, and why my board members and I have a deep love in our heart for the scholarship program. It is now a state program, and thanks to the bipartisan support from the legislature and the governor, it's a state program that's grown substantially in recent years, and we're very grateful for that, and think that that's a great way to invest money to support the highly vulnerable kids that Representative Crucia was mentioning. So the origins of that program, in 2006, an organization called the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation was formed. That foundation raised about $20 million in private money that was invested to find, specifically to find cost-effective ways to use early education to narrow Minnesota's achievement gaps. And in 2006, achievement gap wasn't something that was talked about as much, but that was definitely the driving kind of premise behind both the establishment of the Early Learning Foundation and also the their work. There's really never been anything quite like the Early Learning Foundation, which was affectionately known at the time as MELF, in any other state. And what it really did was set up Minnesota with an evidence-based roadmap backed with millions of dollars of privately funded piloting and evaluation to kind of see a way forward for supporting kids and helping to address gaps. So as I mentioned, the organization I work for is called Close Gaps by Five. We're a direct successor organization to the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. Many of the business and community leaders that were involved in that effort continue to serve on the board of directors for Close Gaps by Five. And we continue to carry a banner for early education as a key strategy in addressing achievement gaps in Minnesota. Those gaps, as you all know, pose a great threat to kids, communities, and also the state's economy. Our premise is that gaps in later achievement are caused by gaps in opportunity at the outset. And we see those gaps, particularly in the case that we work on, in terms of the inability of low-income families to access high-quality early learning programs. If we don't solve that problem, we won't close achievement gaps over the long run, and we won't be ensuring equality of opportunity for Minnesota's youngest learners. That has competitiveness implications, as I mentioned. And I think it's really important to note for this committee, we just spent a great deal of time focused on four-year-olds, but gaps open much earlier than age four. There's actually evidence of gaps in things like vocabulary development or early language development that can be measured and differentiated based on the socioeconomic status of families as early as 18 months. Quite significant gaps in vocabulary development is kind of the most concrete example. So the gaps open early, and we believe that you have to intervene early and address those gaps early. And we agree with the committee that high-quality child care and access to high-quality child care is absolutely critical for doing so. I have a little note here to myself because I want to mention just to make sure you all kind of have in your heads as you hear this testimony. So in Minnesota, 69% of 0 to 2-year-olds or kids that are not yet preschool age, 69% of them are in child care regularly, and 82% of 3- and 4-year-olds are in child care regularly. So that's in Minnesota. The child care sector is where kids are currently. There are kids served, obviously, in school-based programs and Head Start programs. We also support all of those options, but a significant portion of kids are in child care. I want to just move on to talking a little bit about what the Early Learning Foundation learned when it looked at research and kind of the pilot approach that it took to developing the scholarship program. So I think before coming up with a solution, the Early Learning Foundation staff consulted research and a little bit of kind of common sense stuff and came up with a list of principles or criteria to use in developing a program. First, certainly target the kids at highest risk. And I think we would extend that, you know, we use income often as a proxy. And I think that research shows that that is a good proxy. But I think as efforts in Minnesota develop, doing some more maybe what you could call hyper-targeting or focusing on kids in certain at-risk groups, especially if resources are limited, makes a lot of sense. So we support as part of our agenda children in foster care, children in the child protection system, children experiencing homelessness or high mobility. The next principle that was used in determining what kind of policy solutions to offer was offering parents choice and flexibility. The commissioner mentioned several times the importance of having different options available for families. We also support having options available for families. I think when you talk to families about how they made their choice or what kinds of things are important to them with their really young children, location is critically important. It needs to be convenient. A lot of times you're getting dropped off on when your parents are on their way to work or picked up in the afternoon. Schedule, thinking about how those options fit together with parents' work schedules in terms of how many hours they work or what shift they work. Things like that, family values, culture, other preferences. There are a lot of things, as many of you or parents know, that go into choosing an environment for your child. Portability is something that's critically important and is a shortcoming in several other programs. Representative Dabney mentioned the child care assistance program. You know, if you move to a county that has a wait list, you're put at the bottom of that wait list because that program is underfunded. So we really wanted to create a policy solution that didn't allow kids to be cut off often. So thinking about one-time eligibility, not shifting things around when kids and families change location or when parents earn a little bit more income or their hours change, that was important. Quality, for obvious reasons, is a must-have. Thinking about kindergarten readiness, best practices, and we support the parent aware ratings in terms of a quality determinant. Having full day, full year options available, again, thinking about what kids need in terms of their exposure, duration, how often they're in a program, how often they're in care that's not their parents, if their parents are working full time, having those options available, and then starting early, as I mentioned earlier, gaps open early. Kids are often in childcare settings early, so thinking about how to meet kids and families where they are and support their access to programs that fit their needs. So with all of that in mind, MELF created and piloted what at the time was a new approach. There were, you know, as there are now, several other approaches happening, but none really embodied this full array of research-based criteria. So MEL created and piloted the scholarship program and the parent aware ratings, which is known, believe it or not, around the country as the Minnesota model for early learning. I have the great pleasure of traveling around a little bit, but folks like Art Rolnick and Rob Grinwald get around the country a lot and talk about this model. There's a lot of interest in this work that's happening in Minnesota and the research surrounding it. So that, you know, that was the genesis of the pilot. The pilot happened. The pilot, we would say, worked. I think primarily just focusing in terms of kids' outcomes. Children that were in those parent-aware rated settings during the pilot, and this has since been evaluated again since statewide implementation of parent-aware. Children in programs of all STAR levels make significant gains. So that is better gains than you would expect just based on their natural development. Significant gains in their year before kindergarten. And really, and I think this is critically important for policymakers to think about, they make gains on a variety of dimensions, and we're interested in gains on a variety of dimensions. So we're not just interested. A lot of times it's easy to really get focused on early math or early literacy, because those are the things that are measured later with the MCAs. But the ability for children to do well later on the MCAs is much more grounded in their early experiences in terms of their social-emotional development or executive function. You think about a skill like persistence, being able to stick with a task, or being able to, this is true for your whole life, right, being able to get along with the person sitting next to you. You guys aren't, like, bumping into each other and wiggling around. Those kinds of foundational skills that are developed in the early years are the things that later allow kids to really excel at math or reading. You know, absolutely, of course, there are foundational, you know, literacy skills that happen, but when you look at the long-term research, and it hasn't been talked about today, but a lot of people like to talk about the return on investment research, that stuff is all really based on what I think are inappropriately called soft skills. So your ability to do well in school or get and hold a job later in life really links back to skills that you develop in early childhood that are about how you relate to other people, how your brain processes information and deals with different environments that you're in. So I appreciate your indulgence in a little bit of in the weeds there, but I think it's so, so important, especially as we, as an early childhood field, kind of come together with the K-12 field, that the early childhood field continues to really bring forward the importance of looking at a whole child and serving that whole child. So since the pilot, as I mentioned at the beginning of my testimony, scholarships have been scaled up. There are scholarships all over the state now. Commissioner mentioned about in the last fiscal year, I believe 11,000 children used scholarships. I wanted to point out that that scholarship recipient children are not just four-year-olds. 56% are 4 years old. 32% are 3 years old, and then there's a group of what I call really lucky infants and toddlers who, mostly because their older siblings have a scholarship, get a scholarship too, and that comprises 12% of scholarship recipients. Scholarships are in use an array of different program types. 49% are used in public school-based programs. So, you know, I think the idea that scholarships are for private child care providers or are somehow meant to serve kids who are in either family child care or child care centers is false. Scholarships are in use not only in public school-based programs, but also in Head Start programs, as well as child care. So 49% in public school-based programs, 14% in Head Start programs, and 37% in child care programs, including both center and home-based child care programs. So that is what's happening. As I mentioned, there has been subsequent evaluation of the scholarship recipient children and their outcomes, again, looking at the whole child. And what that evaluation found is that, again, kids are making gains on important skills, both social, emotional, and executive function skills, as well as early literacy and math skills. They're making progress on those skills in their year before kindergarten, kind of better than would be happening if they were just developing. So the programs are having an impact on the development of these children. But I think it's also important to note that the magnitude of the gains, even when low-income kids are outperforming their higher-income counterparts, which we see in certain skills, the magnitude of those gains aren't enough to close the gap. The gaps are so wide by the time that children are four that we're not able to, or the existing stock of programs that we have, including school-based programs, Head Start programs, and child care programs, aren't able to support gains that are big enough to close those gaps. So our conclusion is, which is also where I started, we need to figure out how to start earlier for children who are at high risk or have deeper needs to make sure that they're in high-quality programs, stable in high-quality programs, for the amount of time that their parents want, starting earlier than age four. So that is, I guess, the conclusion of my prepared remarks about what's happening with the scholarship program and where it came from. I'd be really happy to answer questions from members of the committee if there are any. I'd also be really happy to go back to my seat. Either way.
All right. I think what we'll do, just because we have one last person who has come to testify and she has traveled quite a distance, we'll bring her down and then we'll take questions for for either of you, and, or if anyone, I know the commissioner does have to leave at 2:30. She's got another appointment. She's been very gracious with her time. If there's any questions for the commissioner before she leaves, we'll get those in. So, Ms. DeVos, if you would come down. Just because this time frame always goes faster than I think it will, and we want to make sure we get your testimony in and then have time for questions before we run up against 2:45. And welcome to the committee. If you would please just state your name and if you have an affiliation, of the, I don't know if it's a business or what you do, and then please provide your testimony.
Sounds great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Karen DeVos. I am an early childhood professional from Ada, Minnesota. From 1998 until 2013, I ran a group family child care out of my home. That same year, in 2013, we had a wonderful opportunity to partner with our local nursing home and assisted living facility to fill a need within our community. And so on January 2nd of 2014, Little Learners Early Childhood Center opened its doors. And I'm proud to say that as we begin our fourth year, we are excited to continue to be able to provide a unique environment for children to learn through play and social experiences that not only expand their brains, but also their hearts. During my 19 years in the childcare business, I've seen a lot of changes happen, from no kindergarten readiness within the school and partial day kindergarten, to all-day kindergarten and all-day, two-day-a-week kindergarten readiness. And I would say with every change comes challenges for the providers in our community, as well as for the school and the children and the families we serve. I'm really proud to say that in Ada, we had a wonderful model that was working really, really well. Until the 2016-2017 school year, Ada Borup families had the opportunity to send their child to kindergarten readiness classes that were offered through the public school 2 days a week, all day. These classes were held on Tuesday, Thursdays for one group of children. They were held on Wednesday, Fridays for the other group of children. Mondays were reserved strictly for ECFE programming. Staggering the days and splitting those children allowed for those of us providing all-day and wraparound care, whether it was in a structured preschool setting like Little Learners or in a more relaxed environment like some home child care providers, to be able to serve the needs of the families in our community. The kindergarten readiness program was on a sliding fee based on free and reduced meal numbers. Some families paid for the full amount of readiness, some paid half, and some received the program for free. The school did lose money on this program, and so when the opportunity arose to apply for VPK funding dollars, they really had no choice but to go for it. And the Ada Borup School District was one of the districts awarded the VPK funding for the 2016-2017 school year. I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about the concerns that have arisen, both with families and child care availability since then. The school in our district, as I said, went from a two-day-a-week staggered program to a three-day-per-week program for pretty much all children 4 years and older. This means that the Tuesday-Thursday kids who shared a spot with the Wednesday-Friday kids could no longer share a spot in childcare. They went to a Monday-Wednesday-Friday all-day. What that meant for our center was in August, when everybody was already enrolled and everybody was all ready to go, we found out that the 17 children that we initially had enrolled full-time for our Monday through Friday preschool class, and it was more than 17, but we had those 17 spots filled, that number dropped down to 11 for Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and all of a sudden we had 23 who needed care Tuesdays and Thursdays, which meant that we had to eliminate six families. We could no longer serve them. In addition to eliminating those six children, we also had to look at raising our rates. The children that we eliminated really did not have any options because the home child cares were facing the same issue. So all of a sudden, parents were left to look at changing work schedules, relying on family members, family friends, grandparents, a variety of different ways to make it work so that they could still continue to go to work. And then, like I said, we had to raise our rates for all children, infant through school age, to ensure that we could continue to offer services and not close our doors, we did not want to eliminate all four-year-old positions, and that's really what we were looking at if we didn't raise our rates. The rate changes, interestingly enough, affected the families on child care assistance the most. Because of the way that CCAP maximum rates are structured, there is not one single child of the 17 that we serve on CCAP who does not have an overage. And we are not expensive. Up until this point, little learners ate the majority of the overage costs. We did not charge them to families because they were already struggling to get by. We are going to have to change that in order to continue running. So most likely this spring, our CCAP families are going to have to be billed these overages. For some of those families, that results in more than $50 extra per week per child on top of their copay. So for the single father that I have who has three children, the mother lost the kids, he's taking care of these three kids on his own, he is looking at paying an additional $150 a week on top of his regular living expenses just to have his children in care. These kids came to us with very limited verbal skills. We are doing everything that we can to save them, and this is really hurting it. You have to look at that. Sorry. For many of the families, this overage amount is going to be equivalent to what many of them spend every month on groceries or heating their homes or a mortgage payment. And it kills me that we are going to have to charge them this rate. But we do not have a choice. It's important for me to point out that we do not want to see the school lose the money on their kindergarten readiness program. We love our school. We live in a small community. We want to have a relationship with our school so that we can best meet the needs of all of our children in our town. Early childhood is important. Our four-year-olds are important, but so are our infants and our toddlers and our three-year-olds. Providing the funding and support necessary to help our smallest people can only benefit our great state. But we need to look at where we are putting that funding to best meet the needs of all children, and especially those at the greatest risk, from birth on up. Families need options that provide accessibility. They need a way to truly meet the needs of their workday. Families need options that are affordable, and we are creating a huge affordability issue for all if we continue to fund VPK without looking at other options. Families also need choices. We know that not every child learns the same, and families should be able to choose the program that works best for their child and their family. Putting a child in a setting that is too structured too soon can often result in unfair labeling of children and frustrations for everyone involved. That includes the school teachers and the parents and the child. Not every setting works for every child, and VPK, as it is currently structured, is eliminating those choices. Two of the 72 programs are using a mixed delivery system. Think about that. Two of them. If we continue to fund VPK without looking at other possibilities like increasing CCAP or better accessibility to scholarships, and if we truly end up with all of our four-year-olds in public school Monday through Friday, my small community in Norman County is going to be in a lot of trouble, because I'm expecting that one or two things will most likely happen. Either all child care rates will have to increase dramatically and only the upper class wealthiest families will be able to afford birth to three care, or care will be impossible to find because it's going to shut down the private sector completely. If all funds go to the school and the children follow those funds, there is not a child care economic model as it is now that will allow for being able to provide services for those younger, more expensive to care for children, our infants and toddlers. There is a tremendous shortage of availability already in our county, especially in the infants and toddlers area. And just to kind of, I'm just going to elaborate on that a little bit. I currently have parents that are putting down deposits to start trying to get pregnant this summer in the hopes that they will maybe have an infant spot. It's a big deal. There are only 15 licensed in-home providers in our entire county. There are two legal non-licensed providers in our county, one of whom does not even provide care, and we are the only center in Norman County. We need more family providers. Little Learners needs to have the opportunity to expand. We actually had plans on opening a second facility in a neighboring town in a nursing home, and when the Adabort School District received the funding, we shut that down. We want to see that expanded. The only way that we can keep those rates down is to provide a variety of funding options, not just for our four-year-olds, but for all of early childhood. At Little Learners, we are providing an opportunity for all children in our care to grow emotionally, to grow socially, through beautiful daily interactions with the residents of Benedictine Care Community and the people who live in the assisted living facility. I would invite everybody to come and check it out because it is amazing to see what's happening intergenerationally in our facility. We ask that you please not take away the opportunity for us to continue doing what we're doing. I urge you to take a really good look at how we can meet the needs of all children, especially our most at-risk children beginning at birth, and not just our four-year-olds. Thank you for your time. And if you've got any questions, sorry for getting emotional. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Sabas. I think we do have some questions. Just
of course.
One quick clarification I want to make sure I understood. So
yep.
When the school district got the VPK pilot money, so they were going to
yes.
do their program, I mean, was there any interaction? Did the school contact you to say?
Not at all. Oh. There was nothing. I found out through a Facebook blast.
Okay.
They're well aware of our program, and we've worked with them.
And you'd mentioned that there was a number of four-year-olds that must when the program was 2 days a week and they alternated.
Yep.
And so are most of those children that you, if you're aware, their parents work full-time, so they needed something outside of the preschool, so that's where you came in. You were providing that wraparound service.
We were providing wraparound service. We were also providing additional preschool. So the great thing that was happening was they were getting that really structured preschool setting in the school, and then they were coming to us, and they were getting this really great play-based social-emotional learning the other 2 or 3 days a week that they were coming. I think it worked beautifully. I think they got two different teachers with two different teaching styles. They had an opportunity to go into the school, get familiar with the school, get familiar with riding the bus, and yet also had that chance to be more connected with the social emotional side of their childhood. They weren't expected to be kindergartners. They were allowed to be preschoolers. That's changed.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Voss, for being here. She's from the area of one of the school districts, as she mentioned, in my area that received the funding, and she probably came about 260 miles, so it's pretty dedicated here. But I appreciate you mentioning kind of a lot of the things that I think are real concerns, child care shortage, the CCAP, and that. But I want to get back to kind of what Chairman Loon was mentioning, too, is there a way the school could have designed the schedule? I mean, that would have made it work. And, I mean, is that what it's really kind of coming down to, was the days, or did I miss something?
I think that if we had had the opportunity to sit down, if it really was looked at as a mixed delivery system, if we really were partnering with the schools and this BPK thing was moving forward and somebody was saying, listen, we want you to work with the private sector. We want you to figure this out. I think there's a way we could have made it work. I love that these kids are getting that opportunity in the school a couple days a week. I think it's really great for them. But there was no communication, and I don't know if there will be. And the fact of the matter is that it has been made very, very clear to me that there is no interest in working with the private sector in our community. I want to be careful with how I word it because there's no interest in working within the private sector, and if they can get the funding to get the four-year-olds in school 5 days a week, they're going to do it because why wouldn't they? The school needs the money.
Representative Mark.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and, you know, I guess my impression of this program when it was being passed last year, and I don't know if the commissioner's not here, is that schools would be working collaboratively in this mixed system with all the other providers. I wouldn't just necessarily, I mean, it seems to me that was my understanding. So the fact that there wasn't any communication, I'm not going to talk any further on this here, but we need to talk about that, because if it's a matter of a scheduling and getting together, that would prevent kind of this chain reaction of all these other things that you mentioned are happening, which is detrimental to child care, then we've got to get at that. So thank you for being here and bringing this forward. So.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. DeVos or for Ms. Moss? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. DeVos, was parent aware and getting the rating or whether or not you're rated, has that been an issue at all for you?
We have struggled. We just finished the parent aware process again. A month into the process of getting our new rating, I had my lead infant teacher quit. We then were left with the task of trying to retrain. We brought on a new teacher who, licensing-wise, was completely qualified for teaching. However, because all of her classes and her training was North Dakota, none of it transferred for Parent Aware, which is a huge issue, we sit 45 minutes from Fargo, which means that when we get qualified teachers in, they're coming out of Fargo. And so none of that is working. And so we have enough points. We're a half a point away from having a 4-star rating, but we have a 2-star rating because we couldn't get the career lattice to where it needed to be.
Representative. Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is another issue that we have to take a look at, because this is what I heard from my providers too. And the fact that we don't have this mixed delivery is, as Ms. DeVos has articulated, it's going to kill our private programs. And I thought our intent was to make sure that we held up both the public and the private so that parents do have these choices. I mean, Minnesota's a choice state, so we should be honoring that. So we have to really dig into this and see if we can get this to where it was supposed to be from the start.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I was born in Ada.
Well, we should visit later.
All right. Other questions for either Ms. DeVos or Ms. Moss? I'm sure would be happy to come back down. All right. Then we're going to give everybody a little time to recoup before your next hearings. And Ms. DeVos, thank you so much for traveling the great distance that you did to share your story. We appreciate it. All right, members, that is it for today. Tomorrow we're going to do an overview of charter schools and what we've got going on in Minnesota with charter schools. And we look forward to seeing you all again tomorrow. That committee is adjourned.